Thanks very much, Sam. It's really a very great honor and very great pleasure to be not just part of this panel, but getting ready to open up this discussion on this important topic, this extremely broad topic of political economy and the American tradition. I find it incumbent upon myself to use my, in an effort to use my 12 to 15 minutes effectively, to narrow that down just a bit, and indeed to narrow down our topic on two fronts. As far as political economy goes, I do want to focus principally on the figure whose name has already been invoked, namely Adam Smith. I think Smith is a justifiable focus, at least I hope so, insofar as he's a founding father, of course, of the modern tradition of political economy. And in a panel on the American tradition, it deserves to be mentioned that Smith himself, of course, was a great friend of the American tradition and the American Revolution, as well as a personal friend of some of the American founding fathers, Benjamin Franklin, most notably. So with regard to political economy, I'll focus principally on Smith. What then of the American tradition? And what follows, I want to focus on one specific side of the American tradition, namely Thomas Jefferson's vision for our country as so memorably invoked in the introduction to the Declaration of Independence. Jefferson, of course, famously begins the Declaration by invoking the human being's natural rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And scholars such as myself have spent many hours trying to parse exactly what he may have had in mind there. To be reductive and to put it most simply, at least two different ways of understanding that phrase might come to mind to those trained in political philosophy. One, very clearly, Jefferson seems to echo very directly the 17th century British philosopher John Locke, who so memorably invoked the tradition of life, liberty, and the pursuit of property. On the other hand, Jefferson might seem to some, educated in the classics especially, to echo Aristotle. Aristotle, of course, understood happiness not merely to be material or involving the pursuit of property. Happiness for him, of course, involved a much broader conception, what the Greeks understood to be eudaimonia, and which is, I think, better translated today, not as happiness, but as human flourishing. Now, I don't profess to be a Jefferson scholar, and I won't even try to get into the game of understanding or attempting to understand what Jefferson really meant. But what I do think I can say with some degree of assurance is that for Adam Smith, his interests with regard to happiness most definitely led him in a direction of emphasizing a more robust conception of happiness that we can understand through the lens of Aristotle and human flourishing. In fact, Smith, I think, a case could be made, developed a conception of the link between economic liberty and human flourishing that outpaces that set forth by any other modern political thinker. And I want to spend then the next few minutes by very briefly laying out some of the core elements of Smith's theory of flourishing within his social vision. And I'd like to do that specifically along three discrete lines in Smith, namely economic, political, and moral. Let me begin then with the economic. And to do so, I'd like to invoke Smith's own words. Smith himself very clearly, very directly, and I think very elegantly defines flourishing in an economic context. He does this right in the first book of The Wealth of Nations, the book for which he's, of course, most famous today, his famous economic treatise of 1776. And he provides this definition of human flourishing there in a paragraph devoted to an extremely important subject, one near and dear to Smith's own heart. It is, as Smith says, quote, "the improvement in the circumstances of the lower ranks of the people," end quote. Here Smith very specifically and very directly tells us, quote, "no society can surely be flourishing and happy, of which the far greater part of the members are poor and miserable," end quote. This is a striking claim, and I want to point out just one particular side of it. That is, in this line, Smith, as it happens, lays out the core principle of his entire political economy. Namely, the moral justification of market society consists entirely in the benefits that it brings to the poorest. Smith signals this at several other places right around that quotation, emphasizing that the benefits of a market society is that it brings, quote-unquote, universal opulence to, quote-unquote, the lowest ranks of the people. Scholars have come to emphasize this side of Adam Smith much more in recent decades, but it seems to me well beyond the scholarly discussion of what Adam Smith may truly have meant, that our popular understandings and our own popular moral defenses of capitalism today would benefit from increased attention to this side of Smith's discussion. For it's precisely this normative claim on which Smith himself based his moral defense of capitalism, and it's a claim in which we hear from certain quarters, but from which one might wish that we heard even more robustly in our contemporary discussions. Now, much more, of course, can be said about this side of Smith's economics, but I want to turn to a second side of flourishing in Smith, and that concerns specifically the political. To see this, I want to turn also, again invoking Smith's words, from his famous, most famous book of 1776, The Wealth of Nations, to his other book, first published in 1759, that I know many of you will know. This is his Theory of Moral Sentiments. There, I want to look at this book specifically to note the vision of the flourishing society that Smith lays out in the Theory of Moral Sentiments. Here in this text, Smith specifically explains, and here again, I hope you'll indulge me if I quote, not too great at length, but, quote, "All the members of human society stand in need of each other's assistance and are likewise exposed to mutual injuries. Where the necessary assistance is reciprocally afforded from love, from gratitude, from friendship and esteem, the society flourishes and is happy. All the different members of it are bound together by the agreeable bands of love and affection and are, as it were, drawn to one common center of mutual good offices." End of quote. This is from the second book of the Theory of Moral Sentiments. Now, this, too, I think, is a quite striking vision of a flourishing society, and I want to emphasize just one element of it here. And this concerns the defining feature of such a society, what Smith calls the, quote-unquote, agreeable bands of love and affection. Now, it's striking to many, I think, that Adam Smith, the founding father of modern capitalism, should have said this. Some may be disappointed upon hearing this, having hoped for Smith from Smith for rather more full-throated praises of self-interest and self-interest alone. Others, more cynical, may be inclined to doubt the empirical reality of such a society. Are there ever really societies such as this that focus specifically on the agreeable bands of love and affection? Smith himself had some doubts that such a society could ever come to be in any full sense. But what's significant here is not the question of empirical reality for Smith, but rather the fact that this, the agreeable bands of love and affection on which a society could be founded, this was an ideal that Smith very clearly cherished. That is, even as he knew that we needed to legislate for a second best world and create institutions capable of governing man as he is, Smith yet thought we needed an ideal, a pole star, as it were, to guide us. And it seems to me that this is what his vision of a quote-unquote flourishing society built on love provides. It's a vision I think that we would do well not to lose sight of, even as we full-throatedly admit that it may be impossible to realize this in practice in its fullest and complete sense. Again, much more could, of course, be said about this, and I hope that perhaps in questions and answers we might have a chance to return to some of these claims. But in the interest of time, I want to push forward into the third front on which Smith discusses human flourishing, and that is what might be loosely called the moral front. On this front, I want to turn to a slightly different way of conceiving human flourishing, and that consists specifically of human nature and how the individual might be understood to flourish. Here again, in the second book of the Theory of Moral Sentiments, Smith invokes flourishing and does so specifically in this context. One last quote, if you'll indulge me. Quote, "The orderly and flourishing state of society is agreeable to man, and he takes delight in contemplating it. Its disorder and confusion, on the contrary, is the object of his aversion, and he is chagrined at whatever tends to produce it," end quote. Once again, we find a tremendous amount packed into a very short phrase. And once again, I want to focus on just one element of it. And that is that Smith is here turning from describing the flourishing society to the question of how we see this flourishing. Specifically, Smith seems to be claiming that we seem to be so made as human beings that we're pleased by seeing flourishing. In a very real sense, we ourselves flourish when we contemplate flourishing. I won't push this too far, but suffice it to say that Adam Smith is not unaware of certain philosophical claims, even amidst his more concrete political and economic analysis. All told, then, it seems to me that Smith's vision of human flourishing encompasses three discrete elements. First, an economic order capable of relieving extreme poverty and bringing opportunity across the board. Secondly, a social order that preserves bonds of love that go beyond mere self-interest. And third, a moral order that allows human beings to flourish by providing them with an opportunity to contemplate flourishing. All of this is to say, I think, that Smith had a quite capacious view of human happiness, one that goes well beyond incremental material gains with which his name is often associated. Further, I think it's one that we, in many respects, would do well today to engage and even to recover if we're serious about preserving and perpetuating the quote-unquote American tradition. Thank you very much.